That's why I'm excited about what we see happening right now in our country. We have new political entrants. There's clearly a feeling in the country that not everyone's satisfied with the status quo and people are putting their hands up. And I'm always for helping new entrants and saying, I know how hard it is to be in that particular role. And so I applaud them for their bravery, and we must lend our hands to them. Even if somebody doesn't necessarily want to be a parliamentarian or a councillor, you know, there's so many other ways to get involved. Volunteer your time, donate. And I really think we need that culture in South Africa.
Hi, I'm Mike Abel. I'm a business, marketing and communications specialist and the founder of MNC Saatchi Abel. I'm a family man, a problem solver, a futurist, an optimist at heart. Welcome to my podcast, Willing and Able, the home of hopeful conversations that challenge perspectives. It's a continuation of the ideas and conversations I began in my book, Willing and Able, Lessons from a Decade in Crisis. My guest today is public speaker, entrepreneur and activist, Mbali Ntuli. Mbali spent 15 years as a DA councillor and filled roles such as youth leader and member of the provincial legislature for KZN, and even contested the party leadership nationally before becoming founder and CEO of Groundwork Collective, a community development initiative. So great to have you here today, Mbali.
Thank you so much for having me, Mike. It's always great to see you.
Yeah, we're going to have a wonderful conversation over the next 60 minutes or so.
Looking forward to it.
To the average person who has just heard my introduction, it might be surprising to know that you are also in the taxi business.
Yeah.
Funny enough, I actually also worked a little bit in the taxi business in the 80s.
Yeah,
with Unkredo in the Eastern Cape.
Okay.
In Motherwell, Zwide, KwaZakhele. So let's talk to Mbali, the taxi owner. What have you learned through this, and what lessons have you carried into other areas of your life?
Well, let me maybe just take you back a little bit into how I got into the taxi industry. So obviously my dad was born during apartheid. There wasn't many means of economic prosperity for black people. And he used to drive a little taxi. And back in those days, it was sort of these little car-like taxi things. And what he figured out was that a lot of people needed to get into rural areas and township areas. And the municipal buses of the sort that were available at the time just didn't do it.
Mm.
And he found himself a niche, particularly in northern KZN, of being able to get into these areas. And it grew into a business. And he became the first person, along with Simon Gaba, to found the Taxi Association, and the first of its kind really in South Africa. And that was, you know, probably one of the few ways that black people at that time could really accumulate wealth, which also came obviously with a lot of violence and a lot of vying for positions. But essentially my family was one of two in the whole province that had access to any routes, and then were able to codify many of the rules that at that time were what the taxi industry were.
Mm.
And some of them were great, you know. They had a proper widow's fund because they understood generational wealth, and that if people died, you needed someone to be able to still maintain their family. So they had that. They would give to communities and teachers and really try to, I think, in their version of the way of looking at the world, you know, uplift black communities in a way that society and certainly the government wasn't doing at the time. And they felt very, very strongly that it needed to be something that stayed in families. And so that's why, for a long time, and I think KZN might be one of the few provinces that still does it, taxi routes pass on into the family. And
so
that's how I entered into the taxi business. So my father died when I was 8. The same year, Simon Gaba also died, and it left a huge vacuum in the taxi industry in KZN in 96, started the big taxi wars. And this was also just after democracy. So a lot of people that were in exile and political parties came back. Their only real skills were, you know, being people that could use guns. So a lot of them became hitmen. And this is where you get the amalgamation of the hitmen in Gabis and the taxi industry.
Mm.
Anyway, long story short, when I was of age, because my mother took over the business, and it was very tough for her because obviously she had a target on her back and she was one of the first females to get in there. But she kept the business alive until my brother and I were old enough. And then she passed on two taxis to us to then be able to run. And we have those routes because our father had started those routes. And I think for me, what I learned just watching all of this happen, I mean, there was lots of violence, assassinations on our lives all the time. We had to go to boarding school. We had bodyguards. Was two things that I think are important. Power is never, ever given. You have to take it. And you have to also not be afraid of conflict. And I think those two things have been very important also in my political career, but also in life, because I'm not really afraid of anything. I think after the trauma of everything I've seen and just seeing the worst and best of people in the taxi industry, you get both. For me, I think the lessons that I carry with me is to never assume that people are just going to make space and make a way for you. And that if you want to do something and if you believe in it, you have to go for it. And you need to do it and back yourself, essentially, because no one's just going to step away and do it for you. And then with that is also, you know, conflict. To not be afraid of it and to not always view it as something that is, you know, binary. It's being able to deal with conflict is not something that means that you always want to engage in violence, but sometimes it's also the way to really establish boundaries for people. Mm. And there's no better place that teaches you that than the taxi industry. So very interesting part of my life. I've stepped away from it a little bit now that I'm a mom. It's just very intensive. You need to be fully hands-on all the time, and I really want to focus on my family. So with everything I've got going on, I've stepped away a little bit. I still help my mom here and there, but I'll get back to it when my children are a little bit older.
So your mom and your brother are still very much involved in driving the family business, if you like.
They are. But, you know, my mom is, she's just so incredible. She also allowed my brother, when I stepped away, to also just go and pursue more of what he wants to.
Yeah.
And then he's very business-minded and orientated. So he wanted to move to Johannesburg to figure out some business on his own. So even he's kind of stepped away, which unfortunately has left it to my poor mom to still continue. But I think she also enjoys it. I think it's the kind of industry where it's very hard to step out of it because you do need to be hands-on. You need to be watching all the time.
Mm. How old is your mom, by the way?
She turned 60 this year.
Okay, so she's still young.
She is, yeah. Although she loves to pretend that she's very old.
Because she's a go-go now.
Yeah, because she's a go-go. Yeah, she loves to pretend she's old. But no, she's 60 and she's still very, very full of life and just mom, always. When I was coming here today, she was telling me to make sure that I've combed my hair and I don't embarrass her, so.
Well, I think that she needs to know that her daughter is one of the best groomed people I've ever met. She always looks $1 billion every time I see her. Can pass that message. Yeah. Well, she'll hear the podcast, yeah, I'm sure. And Abali, it's very interesting what you said about conflict, because I think that that's something incredibly valuable for you and I to talk about a little bit, because really what we want to do is to, I guess, impart useful wisdoms and insights. And I think in society today, people don't really know how to deal with conflict in so many ways, where they conflate or confuse the what with the how.
Mm.
So if they disagree with somebody, they feel uncomfortable. And so the manifestation of that disagreement is anger.
Yeah.
So if I don't agree with your opinion, instead of saying, you know what, I actually don't see it your way, we get cross and we say, you are wrong.
Mm.
We don't often come at it from our own place of comfort, our own place of values, whatever it might be. In terms of handling conflict, what are the lessons that you've learned in terms of effectively managing it?
I think the self-awareness is quite important, because you also then don't take everything personally, and you can be okay with people actually disagreeing with you and that not being a conflict that has to get to the final stages of a major showdown or to see someone as your enemy just because they disagree with you. For me, particularly in my political career, I think that was one of the things that I really grappled with, not understanding why everyone wasn't like that. So you would disagree with someone, sometimes somebody who was considered senior to you, and I suppose naively thinking that they would take it as being constructive and being something that would be the betterment for either the organization or the particular plan that was having. But what I really realized is that people, to your point, who have their own wounds or whatever it is internally, don't always see disagreement in that way and find it to be a conflict that must be, you know, a zero-sum game of now we are enemies because we disagree. And it took me a long time to realize that that was really mainly because of the insecurities, because what you end up doing is constantly trying to explain what you mean, why you think this is. And so I think probably for me, I've always been comfortable with conflict. I've always been able to stand up for what I believe and be fine with people not liking that or people not agreeing with me and not taking it personally and being able to really be fine with the person the next day. And I suppose this goes all the way to me being young and standing up for bullies or standing up to bullies when I saw them doing that with people. And that's always been, I think, a big part of just who I am. And that's why I think I went into the work that I did and why I continue to do what I do now. I like to stand up for people that have voices. I feel like a big part of what life has given me is the ability to do that. And that's something that I should give back to those who aren't able to. And so if that means that sometimes I have to be in conflict with people, then I'm okay with that. But I know that it's never about being personal, and I know it's never about trying to hurt someone or to, you know, damage them. It's really about trying to get to a solution. But I'm also very comfortable if somebody's not happy with me, and I can live very easy with that. As long as I feel like I've done what I feel is right and principled, I'll sleep just fine at night.
Yeah. Many years ago, and I might have reflected actually in it in one of the previous podcasts, where a friend of mine asked me a question when I was discussing something with him. He said to me, "Mike, do you want to be liked or do you want to be real?" And there's nothing worse than being liked for not being real, because then you're not really liked. Yeah. They're liking some version of you, not you in and of itself. So I think a big part of the journey is to embrace conflict, to feel comfortable with conflict, but at the same time to not, I guess, seek out conflict.
100%.
You know.
And this is why I also just said, you know, at the beginning, that self-awareness, I think, is an important aspect for how one deals with conflict. Mm. Because obviously neither you or I are the kind of people who actively go seeking it.
Yes.
But if it comes, then we are comfortable to stand in it, because I think we believe that our values and our principles will hold us in good stead about how we deal with it. And I don't think a lot of people sometimes have that. Certainly in my career, I didn't experience that. I found people that would lash out, that would have their deep insecurities play into the conflict and would end up being incredibly messy and toxic in many ways.
Mm.
But I think it was much worse for them internally than they realized. Yeah, so I think successful conflict resolution also requires a great degree of self-awareness.
And the ability to, as you correctly say, understand what you've done, and if you feel that you have erred, to make good on that. Because a lot of people, when they feel that they've done something wrong or feel guilty about something, it often manifests in even worse behavior to somebody, because they feel they've wronged them.
Yeah.
You know, which is, I guess, a mystery in and of itself. So politics, because it's a very, very interesting career choice. You know, very few people I know have gone in, well, I know quite a lot of politicians.
I was about to say, I'm sure you know a lot.
But by and large, when you think about careers, very few people choose a career in politics. And it's a very brutal career by what I've seen. And I'm amazed how many thin-skinned people go into politics because they're happy to dish it out, but they're not very good at taking it, is one of the observations I've made. What led you into politics? What was it about it that, I mean, I know we've heard already that you like to rescue and save people, whether they want it or not. But what led you into politics?
So this is one of these questions that I still ponder about for myself, because was it innate that I was just someone who was really interested in politics? I certainly was from a young age, and I have a lot of relatives and my mom who recount that. And I remember quite distinctly being young and meeting the Queen when I was 7. I'd won a competition and she was coming to South Africa for the first time in a long time to meet her. And I understood the concept of what she kind of did, and I didn't know I was a Republican then. So I just thought it was cool that you got to make up cool rules to help people and do stuff. But I think also, again, just to go back to the stories that shape us. When my dad died, we at the time were living in the suburb of La Lucia in Durban. We were one of the first black families that were there. And culturally, in my culture, if somebody passes away, you slaughter a cow and some animals where their home was. And so, of course, we had these cows in the suburbs of La Lucia, and one of them got loose and started running around. So obviously, all the white people in the neighborhood were really shocked about that. And there was a big, big drama, and people were coming out. And I mean, there was already a little bit of tension in the area. But one of the things that I really do remember was that just after that, when the situation had calmed down, a man called Roger Burrows came to speak to my mom to ask her, you know, stuff about the cultural rights and what was this about, and to really get a sense. And she spoke to him, and we were in the living room too. And he was really kind. And this was in 1996. So I think just after the big sort of 94 euphoria and South Africa was figuring out its way of living together. I remember him coming back several times to check up on us and to check that we were integrating well into the community. And to his credit, and many of the people around us, they were really awesome. And to me, it seemed really great that you could have this person who was at the time the leader of the DP, be humble enough to come to a small family and to make them feel welcome and to really use politics at well. And then he used a lot of the knowledge that my mom gave him to help write some of the bylaws around cultural rights, which, I mean, they still exist today in South Africa. And so it's all these little stories that lead up to that. I suppose also the trauma of losing a father, seeing my mom have to struggle to find her place in the business, being taken away, going to boarding school, a sense of just feeling sometimes the injustice of not always being able to do things and wanting to always be in a position where I wouldn't feel that way anymore, whether for myself or anyone else. And then just a general love of history and the world and people. For me, that is what politics is. It's how the world and people integrate together and how that makes societies form. And so I was always a student of history. And I think for me, naturally, politics just was always what I really wanted to do. And again, because I haven't figured out for myself whether it was more personal or more, you know, also then having leadership roles, what eventually leads you to it. But at least by 12, I was telling people that I wanted to go into politics. And so that's what I thought I would do. And my politics at the time, I thought would be some form of social activism more than it was straight politics. But by the time I got to university, I understood a bit more about who I was and the ideologies I thought I felt closely aligned with. And I remember this young girl at a computer lab pressing Control Alt Delete. And she was pressing them individually while I was there to come and print something. And I asked her what she was doing. And she told me that she was trying to open the computer. And this is how they told her. And basically, it turned out that she hadn't used a computer before. And she was on the same level and competing with somebody like myself who had had one all her life. And so felt that that was quite unfair. And I mean, I'm fast forwarding this answer quite a bit. But I took her to go and speak to what was a student affairs person at that stage to figure out what we could do about this. When I got back to my res, I found that there were many people like that. And I thought that there was a great injustice of having them compete at the same sort of level. And so one of the things I did was to try and organize them. And I reached out to political parties to see who could help to really run this as an issue, to make sure that we had some kind of way for people to meet together and then get help. And of course, the ANC and the IFP, who, you know, had been great friends of my father and family for many years, thought I was a coconut and didn't take me seriously.
Really?
And the first party, they're no longer though. Now they love me. And sure, the one party that actually was quite open was the DA. So then after that, I interacted with the DA. I'd already figured that I was socially quite a liberal person. And yeah, from there I started the DA's first DASO branch at Rhodes, which then went on to be the strongest branch.
Okay, so this was at Rhodes University.
Yes, it's at Rhodes University.
Makande, in Grahamstown.
It is, yes, okay. Of course, because you're from the Eastern Cape.
I am indeed.
Yeah, a proud Rhodent over
here. Kabeche.
Yeah, majored in tequila and politics. No, oh my gosh.
I think
Mom,
I majored in Sambuca. I can still do a flaming Sambuca if you want me to.
Oh, you're brave. So yeah, that was my great journey. But I think just the amalgamation of a number of incidents. But I always felt that I wanted to be in the social activism space.
And so, because it was interesting, because when you're talking about this gentleman, Roger, that would pop over to your house, I wondered, because you said he was from the DP, and whether if he played any influence in leading you into the DA.
So not at that stage at all, in fact. Yeah, yeah. But what I think might have been happening subconsciously was also just not thinking that the DA was alien. And so when it came time for me to be able to join a political party, despite the fact that I knew and even had family members, you know, in the ANC and the IFP, my family was very close to Kingsway Letini as well. Naturally, I think what I went towards, because it wasn't foreign to me, was the DA, because they were open to me, because at that time, at least, they were talking about being liberal about a lot more things than I think, sadly, they've turned out to be now. But so it felt like a great alignment and a great place to also be able to carve out a space for myself. And between myself and a few other young people around the party at that particular time, we then, in 2 years after that, we were able to convince the party to have a youth congress. I became its first chairperson, then its youth leader the following congress with like a 99% vote. And for a while there, we did great work. We put the DA on every single campus. We started great campaigns. We got the DA on Twitter, which maybe wasn't a good idea looking back now. And we had really funky youth-focused campaigns. So that was that was that, yeah.
When you talk about the DA on Twitter, I always think of Phumzile van Damme and her being the keyboard warrior of the DA until she left as well.
Yeah, I think of somebody else, but they seem to be behaving now.
Okay, yeah. No. Well, hopefully they took the phone away from that particular person if we're thinking of the same lady.
I'm sure we are.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So if you were going to give any advice to somebody listening in here that's thinking of politics, I guess, as a career, because, you know, you've now stepped out. I have no doubt one day you'll step back in and maybe you'll be our president one day, please God. But what advice would you give them if somebody is listening and says, oh, that sounds cool. It sounds like a, because I think people have got the totally wrong idea, Bali, let me say that, of politics in South Africa, because my understanding of you is you went into politics to serve and so many people go into politics to take.
Mm.
And I don't know if politics today allows for serving. What is your thinking around that? What's your advice to somebody listening and thinking maybe politics?
I think people should definitely go for it. I mean, as much as I'm out of formal representative politics now, there was no greater fulfillment than being able to do some of the incredible work that I got to do. So everything ranging from getting people who'd never had IDs to get IDs, getting kids into school, helping to write legislative bills on sex offenders that stand till today to not be able to continuing teaching children, there's a great amount that you can do, even on the opposition ventures. And I think we need more patriotic South Africans that are willing to put their hands up. But I also understand why people didn't before. It's been such a dirty, dirty game with, quite frankly, very low quality levels of representatives across the board. And so if you are a person who's got a really great career somewhere, but you want to serve your country, I could see why it would not be attractive. But that's why I'm excited about what we see happening right now in our country. We have new political entrants. There's clearly a feeling in the country that not everyone's satisfied with the status quo and people are putting their hands up. And I'm always for helping new entrants and saying, I know how hard it is to be in that particular role. And so I applaud them for their bravery. And we must lend our hands to them. Even if somebody doesn't necessarily want to be a parliamentarian or a counselor, you know, there's so many other ways to get involved. Volunteer your time, donate. And I really think we need that culture in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
The best countries are the ones with the most active citizens. And I think we have let that slide for the last 30 years and we need to reset our country. And the only way is if we all get involved. So I encourage people. And it's also fun. Is that a big element that people that people don't realize? Part of this is really fun.
The only fun I ever see is the start of the State of the Nation when the chaos ensues.
People are pummeling each other.
Yeah, so it's very interesting because, you know, when you look at the elections coming up, 29 May 2024, it seems to me like we are at a crossroads as a country right now. You know, there are new parties on the rise. There are big established parties on the decline.
Mm.
It kind of feels to me like it's a turning point in many ways for the country. One of my early guests in the podcast series was Sonkezo Zibi.
Oh, yeah.
Because it interested me how somebody had left a very successful corporate career who had no history like you in politics and no grounding in politics, but you know, some people go, I guess, into the ministry when they have a calling, and yet he had a calling to go into politics.
Mm.
So I think I'd love to hear some of your perspectives, if you like, on what how you see it playing out. And nobody's going to be holding you accountable, but
no,
what are your views? I'll throw the bones. You read them.
Well, yeah, just on, you know, Sonkezo Zibi and Rise, I think it's been very impressive how they've been able to have a professional organization. I don't think South Africans appreciate how difficult it is to start a party, to get volunteers, to do fundraising. Even something that seems as simple as putting up posters is a hell of a lot of work. And so the fact that as a new entrant, even with these new laws, they've been able to get on there, I think that that's really great. And the other parties as well, you know, Action SA, although they had a bit of a head start, but it's great. I love these elections. I think there's so many things up in the air. My feeling is that the ANC will be below 50%, but I don't think anywhere near the 35% we see you know, people polling. I think more 47, 48, but psychologically, I think that's going to be huge for our country. It's going to be huge to have that shift and to finally get people galvanized into believing that actually their votes mean something and then really getting stuck in 2026 and 2029, which I think will be the real showdown. I think KZN's up for grabs right now. And living there, I can tell you that I'm extremely worried about what that potential coalition might look like. If the MK is focused enough to get on, the baddest by getting all their signatures, I think there will be a kingmaker. And I mean,
and how terrifying is that, really?
It is quite terrifying because I actually haven't heard of anything that they've said that gives me any hope that there aren't going to be complete chaos. I mean, everything from saying that they want, you know, the LGBT community to be, I don't know, what did he say? He wants them to be locked up or whatever the case was. Yeah, there was some nonsensical
thing. That's a violation of our constitution.
Well, the other one is that single mothers must be sent to Robben Island. So, I mean, they're not really trying to be a constitution.
Single mothers. So our father's not involved in creating single mothers.
I mean, these are the questions that we must ask. But I do get the sense in KZN that people aren't even really interested about what their manifesto or what their sayings are. They want to have an alternative vote. And I think that KZN and GP might be lost to the ANC. Interesting times.
Mike Abel's book, Willing and Able, Lessons from a Decade in Crisis, captures the stories of clients and partners and the wins, losses, and learnings through his eyes in a career spanning three decades. Whether you're looking for courage or inspiration to learn what it takes to disrupt industries or discover how to transform your company meaningfully and truly empower your people, you'll find it between these pages. You can listen to the audiobook on Audible, download it on your Kindle, order it online, or find it at your favorite bookstore.
Madiba said, "May our choices reflect our hopes, not our fears." And it seems like a lot of these are reflecting our fears and not our hopes. So if people are, I guess, gravitating behind punishing single moms, which is an aberration in and of itself, because so many moms in South Africa are single moms, and so many moms in South Africa don't intend to be single moms, but that's how their lives transpire because they've been let down by their partner in terms of women raising men in South Africa. And I think the other tragedy around that is, as you say, in terms of not embracing people's sexual orientation, I think is disgraceful in 2024. And yet the world itself seems to be in a pretty mad place right now in Bali.
It does. And we have, what, the super election year with 70 elections around the world.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm quite an optimist. So for me, whenever I see a challenge, I think we must run towards it and do what we can do. So yeah, South Africa is not looking great. We've got some mad leaders across the political spectrum. But what is also in our favor is that we've got our young population who aren't historically super aligned to anyone.
Yeah.
And if we just make sure that we get them to really understand what's at stake and how to use democracy, I think that they're going to be far smarter than the generations before us and how they choose who has their best interests at heart. And that's my hope. And that's why I do the work that I do now, because I feel like that's where our low-hanging fruit is as a nation. And we're going to do it. And I know people feel gloomy and like we don't have time and we must get things done now. But that's when you actually become about tactics rather than strategy. And I think we've seen some political parties that have mushroomed up just, you know, to weaken the ANC or to go against the ANC. And that's not really long term, right? We should really be having a culture shift and behavior shift into thinking about what we want democracy to be and how we envision our country shaping up. So there's a lot of work to do. And I think a lot of us are prepared to do it. And so I'm not super gloomy.
Yeah. Well, like you, I also run towards the fire if I see one with my marshmallows because I like bright marshmallows. But when you look at the situation now and people making election choices, and we're going to cut to Groundwork Collective and why you started that and what you do there vis-a-vis social change. But if you had to say to a person listening in right now, this is how I would choose my political party, because democracy is theoretical. Of course, it's a lived thing and it's a practice thing and something that should be enshrined. But if you had to bring it down more to a tangible, on-the-ground reason for voting for a party, what would you say to somebody in terms of how to assess who to vote for, who reflects their values?
Yeah. So I look for a number of different things. I look for a cohort of leadership as opposed to one or a very strong personality type cult sort of leadership.
In terms of old Grootman leadership that used to exist in this country around the world.
Around the world. I think the time for the big man in politics is way over, and particularly in a continent like ours.
Yeah.
So I look to see that there's actually a collective of leadership, because that at least makes me believe that there'll be a diversity of views around the table that reflect our very diverse society, and that that leadership is able to come from different backgrounds, places, and so is diverse in its makeup. And then I look for people that actually know what they're doing and have some level of professionalism and expertise in whatever it might be. You could be the best, you know, librarian or teacher, but there needs to be some of that. And that also includes people who might not have academic qualifications, but are people who have been working in communities, because in a lot of places, those are the people that are actually keeping our democracy alive, because they step into often to do the work that the state has failed to do. So in my job in politics, I often meet, you know, the granny on the street who takes care of all the kids, or the mama who's the one who's basically doing all the NGO work that should be done there. So those people are as equally important to me in the party as the people that, you know, have economics and or masters in economics. And then I also look for a party that has values for me that will give most of the people in our country the best opportunity to really self-actualize and to be what and who they want to be in life. And that can take a variety of shapes and manifest everything from how they view growing the economy to what they believe a society should look like as a vision, to even what they think should be almost a happiness or fun meter of what a society is like. I look for quirky things like that too for myself. There's never going to be a party that's perfect or a leader that's perfect, so I'm not expecting everything to be aligned. But I want a party that has strong constitutional values, that will protect people's freedoms, that will catch people who might not be having the best time in life. But most importantly, that seems to care about the people of South Africa.
Well, I think for me that is critically important, because when you look at political parties around the world and closer to home, a love, a care, commitment and a passion for the citizenry often doesn't seem to be something that one can see manifesting. It seems to be career politicians that are earning big paychecks. You know, I'm always very amused, and when I say amused, unimpressed by the blue light brigades and the way that politicians who are really civil servants, who are really paid by us and our tax money, somehow elevate themselves into being important people, and yet the people that are paying their salaries are the unimportant people. And that's not really an equation that I'm familiar with in a normal work life.
Yeah, we have no shame. Our politicians have no shame in this country. And it's really become skewed because for some reason, we've also made them celebrities, which to me is really weird to have a politician as a celebrity. But that's what we've done with the politicians in South Africa. I mean, we must reflect on that as a society, because I also don't quite understand how we got there.
Yeah. I don't think it's only here. I think politics around the world, you know, I mean, you look at a guy that used to run that reality TV show called The Apprentice and would shout at people that they were fired and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, he became the president of the United States. So who knows what
America
qualifies.
America has to reflect to.
Yeah. And I mean, if you look at the incumbent as well, there are a million and one questions that one could ask. So one of the observations, having spoken about Trump and Biden, and, you know, we spoke about Zuma just now, and even the incumbent, you know, youth. South Africa needs younger people. South Africa needs, you know, fresh ideas. The world needs fresh
Africa
ideas.
Africa also, definitely. Yeah. I think there's something like 4,000 MPs, and most of them are, I think the median age of them was like 75 or something in Africa, just, you know.
Really?
Just, yeah. Whereas the median age for Africa, I think, is something like 27 or 29. So we definitely need more representation. And not just youth, but also women. But I mean, you and I know the arguments for this, but we have to work towards it. So, I mean, these people aren't just going to come out of nowhere. And like you said, you might have people that get degrees and do really well, but they might not have the social capital, the ins, the nuances to be able to play in these worlds. And we all who have been in them need to give them and help them and give them a hand up into these things, which is why I also love the work that another group that you work with, which is Future Elect, does, because that's exactly what they do. They're trying to empower moral and ethical leaders across our continent to be able to take their space and to give them as much resources as they can so that they can do it, because it is a tough and isolating place to be in, especially if you're going against the grain.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that that is the direction we need to be right now, is against the grain. We need to be salmon swimming upstream. Mm. That's the only way we're going to drive change in South Africa.
Why are you so invested in all of this? Because I know just personally that you are always willing and able to help all kinds of organizations that come to you guys, and you have lots of pro bono work, and a lot of it is to try and help this. But why is it so important to you? I mean, you've been very successful at business. You don't really have to be. I mean, it's nice that you are, but what's your personal investment in all of this?
It's very interesting because I am actually, you might not believe this, but apolitical. I have no affiliation to a political party per se. I have an affiliation towards values and towards contribution and to what I think will make the country a better place. And so that is what I gravitate towards. You know, I was very lucky to grow up in a family where I guess I saw service above self. And that was always landed with me as a concept from being a little boy to try and make a difference in the world. And you and our friends, and you probably know this about me already, but you know, I am the grandson of people that left Poland where their entire family was murdered by the Nazis or by the Poles, whichever way you look at it, because the Poles were, you know, very happy collaborators in the Holocaust, as were many other countries, the Romanians and other countries. So when you, Lithuania, when you look at growing up there and then you hear and you think, well, yes, there were not gas chambers here, but there was tyranny, there was horror, there was murder, you know, going on in South Africa in terms of the previous regime. And you look around you and you think, well, you can't be a bystander to this. You need to activate or operate in whichever way you can to bring sanity to bear, to bring change to bear, to help people. And then when apartheid ends, you can't suddenly look at the situation and say, well, okay, great, that's over, and forget about, you know, multiple generations of suppression and what that means in terms of making the country a much more fair place. How do you create an inclusive economy? How do you create a sharing culture in South Africa from all races? And so what you don't want to do is transfer money from white South Africans to black South Africans. What you want to do is raise the entire ocean so that everybody can start to do well and everybody can actually be great neighbors and helpful neighbors to one another. And so often, Bali, you know, you hear about this concept, which I have seen played out. You know, you spoke about the taxi industry and how there are so many amazing people and how many terrible situations go on as well. And I think that South Africa, we have this concept of Ubuntu, which I don't see played out a lot. You know, you see some people do it in spades and magnificently throughout their lives, and other people are just set up to take and to grab. And so we went from one form of state capture in the old regime to another form of state capture in the new regime. And so I just want a much more just and inclusive society, and I don't see any reason why there shouldn't be. And so in my own small way, I try to make a difference. I'm just wired
And I've seen it. I mean, I also, I follow a lot of your professional pages, and I see that even with your hiring decisions, the way your offices are set up, the way that people speak about the culture at your business. And I think that it's a credit to you and obviously your parents and the way that they raised you, that that comes through and flows through naturally in that way. And then also the work that you do, and people don't know this, but I mean, when I started Groundwork Collective, we obviously went to Sajin Abel to help us with the way that, you know, we would try to visualize and brand what we were trying to convey. And we didn't have any money at the time, and you guys were really great, and just being able to do that and helping us grow. And a big part of why we did eventually get money, I think, was the professionalization of how great you made us look.
Thank you.
And that is, that's amazing. And it's not just me. I mean, I've heard it from a number of different organizations that have said the same thing. So I think that that's really great, and it's testament to you living and actually doing what you say you believe.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I mean, for me, it's about living a purposeful life. You know, why would you want to be here? And yes, of course, I've done nicely, but I don't get any, well, you like nice things in life and to do nice things and to eat nice things and to go to lovely places, but that doesn't give you a sense of purpose. I think contributing to society and contributing to people in their careers, and that for me is the most important thing. And like when people say to me, Mike, what's the most important thing you've done in your career? I won't say going up on stage at Cannes to win a Gold Lion for that campaign. And don't get me wrong, I love winning Gold Lions at Cannes and any other awards, but I'll say the street store.
Yeah,
because we've been able to clothe over 1 million people around the world. And that for me is the most important thing, is seeing the impact that we've made in people's lives and we've continued to make in people's lives. Yeah, the street store turns 10 years old this year and well over 1,000 have happened around the world, which is...
That is great. And in fact, now that I think about it, many years ago, you also helped another organization called WEET. I was part of that with Angel Campy and a number of other South African women. So you guys have been doing a lot, actually, now that I think about it. Wow, we go way back, even before I knew you.
We do. We do indeed. But enough about me, because yes, I get embarrassed now. I'll want to run out of the studio any moment. Let's go back to you. So Groundwork Collective, it fascinates me because you're involved in so many different things in terms of food security and access to water and civic education. Talk to us about Groundwork Collective and why you started it and why you lean into it. Because, of course, I know a lot about it, but our listeners don't. And how could they even get involved in helping you behind it?
Sure. So in 2020, after I'd ran the election to become the DA leader, my entire campaign was based on, you know, just a kinder, more accessible, open DA that operated in a very different way. And this was from my experience in working in very rural areas. And I think, you know, it was a long campaign, it was COVID. But 2 years later, I left because I felt like I could actually do a lot of the stuff that I'd wanted to do in the DA, but in a different vehicle. And it was very sad because I love politics and it definitely was my first love. But I believe that if it's meant to be, I'll get back into it. But I didn't also want to sit wasting away or hoping for a shot or another chance for someone to tap me on the shoulder and say, it's finally your time now. And at the same time, you know, just be stagnating as a human being. So I thought I would go out and do it. And what I wanted was to start an organization that looked at the holistic life cycle of a person. So many people in South Africa don't have food or fortified food. Children are stunted. So food production for me was important. When I was growing up, my granny had a homestead. We still do. We visit her often. And we were taught how to grow food. And I just don't see that being a big part of what younger generations get anymore. And so much of their money is being spent on buying food, when if you actually taught them how to do it, they'd be able to do it in a tire, for example. So same with creches and places that don't get government subsidies. So I wanted to make sure, especially as a mom, that no kid would be starving in South Africa. And if this was a way that we could play into that role, then that's what we do. So our first pillar is food production, and that's what we do. And we are piloting and doing a lot of work in many different communities now, which is really great. The second was then, of course, once somebody has some food, then they might need access to a job, especially if they're a young person, to continue being able to live out their goals. So we try to do work where we match them up with mentors or offer them upskilling opportunities so that they're able to do something and not just sit at home, because there's also nothing as heartbreaking, again, when you're doing door-to-door and you just constantly going into home after home after home where people are showing you their matric certificates, their BTEC certificates, and they can't get jobs and they're just sitting at home and eventually just wasting away.
Doctors,
yes, of course, is a huge issue right
now. We have Cubans, but we don't have jobs for our own doctors.
We are just a country in a perpetual state of crisis when it comes to that. So for whatever role we can play, that's what we try to do. And then the last one is, on all things being equal, if someone has food and you've given them some opportunity to now have a job, you want them to be an active citizen. So you want them to also be able to give back into the society to contribute so that we continue the cyclical nature of uplifting each other. And so then we have our third pillar, which is civic education. And for us, this has probably been the biggest and most important one to start off with, because it really encapsulates what we're trying to do. We want to change the behavior of how South Africans participate in the democracy. On average, it doesn't matter whether they're young or old or rich or poor. South Africans just don't know how their government works. They don't know how to get things done outside of waiting for a political party. And so we stay in the state of complete paralysis, not knowing that, you know, you can go and sit in the IDP and be able to give input into the budget for your own ward. Who is your councillor? Have you ever met them? Have you gone to a town hall meeting? Do you know that you can go to council meetings? Things like PPP. There's all this stuff that is part of our constitution and our legislation that makes us the most participatory democracy in the world. We literally get to decide what happens with our taxes at a policing level, at a schooling level. And yet so many of us don't actually do any of that. And I think a big part of it is because people don't know. And so we decided that we were going to do something about that. And we were going to focus particularly on young people, because it's just a bigger age group that exists and that is left out of these conversations. And so we started the exchange campaign. We've been registering young people, thousands of them, for the last year, and we'll continue doing it even after the elections. And once we've registered people, then we take them through the curriculum, because we don't want to ask young people to vote, for example, for a ward councillor, and we haven't explained the difference between a ward and a PR councillor and the multitudes of things. And then, of course, after that, we ask them to be observers for the election. So for these elections, we're aiming to cover 21% of the election stations.
We
can all see it's going to be highly contested. And we want every South African to give 3 hours of their time. Everyone's going to go to vote. And so we'll be launching our portal soon to ask everyone to please volunteer to say that they'll do 3 hours at their voting station. And that's another way of getting people to start being more active. So that's the idea behind Groundwork Collective. Yeah, I think the goal is we're going to be in schools, we're going to have board games, we're going to make it really fun for young people to actively understand democracy. Because I think that if we have that culture and behavior shift, we won't have to worry about these city political parties. Mm. Young people will find that solution on their own and we'll do it.
The Street Store turns 10 this year. The world's first rent-free, premises-free, free pop-up store provides a dignified shopping experience to those in need, allowing them to choose from a selection of pre-loved clothing and shoes. Over 1,000 stores have been hosted around the world in the past decade, and now we're calling on you to host your own. Visit thestreetstore.org to sign up and find out how.
So I love what you're saying, because you are turning things on their head a little bit, you know, with unconventional approaches. One of the things I think you should do is go and see Cadbury's, because, you know, they do that chewing gum called Chappies.
Oh, yeah.
And if you open a Chappies wrap, it says, "Did you know?" And there's all kind of irrelevant rubbish in there. Why? That should be, "Did you know that you could actually change your country by this? Did you know that you can actually have input on the budget? Did you know?" So I think that you and Groundwork Collective and Cadbury's needs a collab on that. No, absolutely. Straight after this, somebody. The other thing is, I see recently that one of your campaigns was handing out KFC vouchers for those who registered for the first time. Now, aside from it being an astonishingly bad idea because you didn't give them Nando's vouchers, shameless pun for one of my clients there. But
we had your other clients who were giving superfluous vouchers.
Aren't they? Are you?
Yeah.
There we go.
See?
Okay, very cool.
You're just all rounders.
So have you seen the need then to offer a bit of a promotion around activating behavior?
I think so. And it's not because I think that people don't care about their democracy. It's because there's so much noise in South Africa that to break through the sound barrier, you almost have to make people see what's in it for them to really pay attention. So I couldn't just say, "Hey, my name is Mbadi and I think it's really important you should vote. So like, why don't you come and register?" Because no one would care. I mean, everyone's saying that. But if I say, "Come and vote, you also get a free KFC voucher guaranteed. This is exciting and we hook you in with that." We've seen a great conversion of those people actually signing up to be volunteers and to wanting to be part of it, because they actually were incentivized by that KFC voucher. Everyone likes a free meal. Mm. And we've also had superb
vouchers.
So when
people say there's no free lunches, they actually are.
They are at Groundwork Collective. So yeah, it was really just around that and that particular strategy. And it's worked well for us, I think, with obviously the use of influencers and celebrities that young people look up to. I think one of the things when we do our observers is also going to be using all the celebrities. I'd love to get like a Francois Pina or someone to remind his generation, go out and do some observation and get him to do some sort of video for us. And all types of people, a Thuli Madonsela, a Lucas Radebe, you know, those people are still people that young people look up to. But I really think South Africans sometimes need a hook of something that interests them. And sports is a great unifier, as we saw last year. So that would be really great. And it's just really about trying, and this is more your world than mine,
I'm taking notes.
Finding a way to get people excited about a brand or an idea. And for us, that's a democracy. So we'll throw everything until we find the very perfect combination.
Yeah. Well, I think it's certainly a fight worth fighting. One of the other things that you spoke about apropos farming is, you know, I think that South Africans have, not just South Africans, all voters around the world have a degree of apathy and victimhood. Mm. Like, this is our lot, as opposed to thinking, I can actually change this. I think that notion or concept does not really live in people's minds, other than maybe rocking up at the ballot and putting the little cross where it belongs. And I think that you and I are outliers, if you like, in this regard, because we absolutely believe that in order for things to change, you need to lead the change.
Yeah.
You know? I think it was Gandhi who said, "Be the change you wish to see in others." But I love this idea of the subsistence farming, because for the longest time in South Africa, I have thought that a way out of hunger, maybe not poverty per se, but hunger, is certainly subsistence farming.
100%.
And if people just learn to, you know, I actually wrote to the Premier about 2 years ago, and I said to him, of the Western Cape, and I said to him, you know, I know Johannesburg is the largest man-made forest in the world.
Wow, yeah, I don't know that.
Yeah, yeah. And I said, well, can't we make Cape Town, Western Cape, the largest vegetable farm in the world, that wherever there's space, you know, and he loved the idea, and he said, go and talk to X, Y, and Z, and then, you know, kind of daily work gets in the way, and there are so many, only so many things that my partners allow me to run at before I get back into the commercial aspects of the firm, heaven forbid. But I did think, you know, just imagine if when you drive even in from the airport, even if you've got pumpkin and you've got squash and you've got potatoes and cabbage, exactly,
spinach,
growing everywhere,
yeah,
where people can just help themselves.
And we will solve childhood stunting. Those first 1,000 days, which are so crucial for a child, we won't have this problem again, because right now we are failing children before they even enter the schooling system.
Yes.
And then we wonder why they can't, you know, concentrate at school or do well. It's because their brains haven't even had the nourishment that they need, because we've let them down. And in a country like ours, where we have everything to do this, this should be a no-brainer.
Absolutely. And it costs very little. It costs
very
the price
little.
Of a packet of seeds and a little bit of earth. The other thing for Groundwork Collective, while we are kicking around some ideas, is I've never understood why people build orphanages separately to old age homes, because what little kids need is love, and what old people need is love. And there's a great coming together in terms of, you know, and especially in a country like ours, where you have old people that are forgotten and thrown a kind of onto the trash heap of memory in a way. And you got these young people that are so desperate for love and attention. And I think there's definitely a very powerful coming together or symbiotic relationship that we could do there. What do you think?
That is a great, great, great idea. And I actually sit on the board of PADCA, which is an old age facility organization in KZN, particularly because I've always seen this and I wanted to find a way to help. And I also used to sit on CROW, which dealt with children and animals. I think that's a great idea, actually. I mean, we'd have to, in this particular country, just because of our sexual abuse, be very careful about how we did it. But thinking of the best, I think that's brilliant and could definitely be piloted. You're giving me lots more work now.
If anyone can do it, it'll be Mbali and Thuli.
Oh,
so.
My cable.
So if you could give advice to your 18-year-old self, what would it be? I mean, I'm pretty sure a big chunk of it will be just do exactly what you did in Mbali, look where you are. But would there be any other advice that you'd like, looking back, reflect on differently?
No.
I knew that was going to be
the... No, I've had a really crazy life, and it's been tough and really horrible, but it's given me great resilience and grit. And I'm just so grateful. And I think a big part of that is because I've known that it could go away at any time. And I live my life with so much gratitude. I'm very happy. I love that I have my kids. I love that I enjoy what I do. So I wouldn't change much. I enjoyed my 20s. I don't miss the party life, so sometimes a little bit, but not too much. Maybe just be kinder to myself a little bit. I think I'm exceptionally hard on myself, and was in my younger years, and I exerted myself sometimes to the point where it wasn't mentally or physically healthy. But also, again, maybe I wouldn't have learned about that if I hadn't done it. So it is a boring way to answer, but no,
it's not boring at all. I mean, I imagine when you have achieved what you have so much in such a short amount of time so far, that would be a logical conclusion.
What
to
would
come
you say to yourself?
No different either.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not that I haven't had hard knocks in life, and that there haven't been profoundly painful experiences along the way, but each one of them has shaped me.
Yeah.
And so you can look at a situation, you can say, how's the situation going to live with me, or how's the situation going to liberate me? And I only look at negative situations in terms of what I can learn from them.
Yeah.
And I accept myself, warts and all. So I know my faults, and I do have faults.
Yeah.
And I embrace those because it's part of who I am.
Me too. And I quite like myself, actually.
Yeah.
I'm very comfortable with who I am. And like you, I know my shortcomings, and you know, you can only try to work towards being better.
Yeah.
That's as much as you can do, and to just be comfortable with that.
Well, that's right. And I say, you know, you never repeat a mistake. You make a mistake once, and thereafter it becomes a decision. I think one needs to take responsibility for that. You know, that if you've done something wrong and you've learned from it, then don't repeat it, you know. Change tactic. So if we're talking about looking back, when you resigned from the DA, as I understand, in your resignation letter, you thanked colleagues from across the political divide and members of the media and the public for both the lashings and the love that whipped you into a stronger, harder leader.
Mm.
And that's interesting for me because you felt that you gained something out of the lashings. Do you think lashings are an important part, metaphorically, in evolving into being a good leader?
I think so. I think they're important for sometimes shaping. I mean, it's not that they were always fair, but again, that's only something you can learn from and accept. So for me in particular, when I said I was thanking colleagues from across the board, I was the youngest female member in the legislature for a long time. And a lot of the IFP and ANC and even EFF women in particular were very protective of me as their daughter more than anything across political spectrums. And I think I'm quite respectful. And so they had a great affinity towards me. But at the same time, you know, because they were much older and I used to come to the legislature, perhaps not dressed as conservatively as I would like, as they would like.
Yeah.
You know, there are those kinds of things where, or because I could sometimes be quite strident in my opposition to them in some things. Oh, that's not really Zulu, you're an uppity young lady. But those were all really important. And same with the public. I mean, the public was really brutal when people like myself and Makashude and Ndiwe Sod in the DA were called coconuts, no one took us seriously, sellouts, black people that, you know, were in the DA were certain types. And that really fortifies your ability to be able to craft a message and stick to it about why you're doing what you're doing and to not waver in your principles and what you believe. And it was important because I think it also helps to drive you to prove that you're doing this for the right reasons. And I think very few people throw those accusations towards me. Sure, probably in the last decade, I don't think anyone has said that, because even though they might not have liked the party, I think they were able to see that you were willing to do the work. And I'd like to think I would have always done it, but I think definitely the lashings of the public in that respect made me all the more acutely aware of what was at stake for me, what I think of what I was doing, and even whatever people absolutely might think about race in the context of me being black in the DA. So those are great.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's an interesting thing because I have a slightly different perspective. And that is, when people were calling you those names and insulting you, I think it's because they took you very seriously, not because they didn't take you seriously. I think if they didn't take you seriously, they would have ignored you. But the fact that they did try and troll you and bring you down means they saw you as a threat. So maybe you want to just ponder on that a little bit, because I thought that you and Lindiwe, Magashula, Musi were doing the most unbelievable job as a collective, Pumzile, to shift the narrative. Because, you know, for me in South Africa, and just looking at pure demographics and taking away anything else, and I'm not talking about identity politics, I'm talking about relating to a political party and thinking that a political party represents the future. I think you have to be a black party that whites vote for in order to have a successful future in the country, because if you don't represent people, not just in terms of values, but in terms of, I see you've got my back, I see you understand me, I don't understand what the future would be for that kind of a party. And I'm not referring to the DA specifically over here. I'm talking about any party around the world. You need to represent the hopes and dreams and aspirations of the people. And if the people comprising that party don't represent that in and of themselves, then why would you go with it? You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think one of the things very interestingly after that is that when we left, and all of us have actually left now, including people like Hlanganani Gumbi, Zwakhele Ncwango, you know, people would say, oh, you failed or you didn't do it. I don't see it like that at all.
I think
what we actually did is, and this is something that I think you need to be comfortable with as a leader too, is you might not be the one that always gets to the end of the journey, but you might be the people that started. And so, of course, you'll be lashed the most, but the next people will have an easier time, and the next people, and the next people. And there's many young people in the DA who constantly tell me, even now, that they joined or were part of the first structures that I did. And there's also many young people outside of just general politics who I meet all the time that talk about their interest in politics being piqued by us at that time.
No question.
And last week, I spoke at one of FutureDect's graduation panels, and three of the women there said that they entered politics because of myself and Indira and were inspired to do so and had not seen other Black young people in there. So that, for me, is very rewarding and doesn't feel like a failure at all. And I hope that they will have more success in whatever political vehicles they choose to continue the good work. So it was tough, but I wouldn't change it at all.
Well, that's the thing. And life is very fluid. So whether or not you're going to come back into it one day or whether or not you're going to be our president one day, I have no idea. But I'd vote for you, Mbali, and I have. One of the interesting things, being the overachiever that you are, you were selected as a Mandela Washington Fellow, which I understand is a flagship program that empowers young people through academic coursework. What can you tell people that might be interested in that? Because I'm sure a lot of people are saying, well, you know, it's unbelievable, Mbali's journey, and it is, and you're still really young. What did you learn from that experience? And is there anything you'd like to impart to our listeners around that?
I thought it was a great program. So obviously it was started by President Obama as a way to try and help young African leaders. And I was in the first year, and I think in that year I was the only South African politician that was chosen, which was very interesting because I ended up having to go to represent South Africa at an AU function, and the president didn't arrive at the time, so it was just myself and Nkosi Sazana looking at each other in a room. But it was a great program. But what I think for me it really showed was that the problems of the US in particular are very similar to what we're facing in South Africa. And there's a lot for us to glean from the rest of the world, particularly so-called more advanced democracies, about what not to do, actually. But I would encourage people to go for it. There's so many programs within the Mandela Washington Fellowship that are really great. And I think South Africans should always take that ability, only because I also think it's really great to leave South Africa to see how wonderful this country is, because I think it invigorates people to fight for it more. And so every single one of the people in my class, I think, have come back and are still contributing very much to South Africa. So,
yeah. And I think that's very valuable, because I think often South Africans travel and study abroad. I remember when Lindiwe, I think, went to Harvard.
Mm.
There's this perspective of things aren't good enough in South Africa, so that's why you've gone to do those things. And it's quite the opposite.
Mm.
It's because you want to pick up a global and a worldly perspective and then to bring those gifts back to South Africa.
100%. And there's just something about also learning from people who, as you say, might be advanced to us in other respects. I mean, one of the things that I really loved was just, you know, campaigning tools. And at that time, this was in 2014, we didn't have as sophisticated sort of polling and software that we do now.
Mm.
And for me, it was really great to even have had that, because I think it held me in good stead in my work that I came back and did in constituencies that were pretty rural and where I put them to good use to help what needed to be done.
So being this career woman and dynamo that you are, you know, some people would not know how to balance motherhood, parenting with careers, but I'm constantly in awe of the magical things you do with your kids and what you post, and your daughter Sarabi amuses me no end.
quite sassy, that one.
Yeah, I can see that. She's a little bully. In terms of parenting, what do you think your kids have taught you? What has motherhood taught you?
Oh, Mike, there's nothing that I love more than being a mom. And I always...
I can see that.
It sounds very cheesy, but I always knew I was going to be a mom, and I always knew that I was going to have my two children. And so to have them at the time just feels already amazing, and I see them as a constant gift. Patience is probably one of the biggest ones, because toddlers are slow. Oh my goodness, they're so slow in a lot of different ways. But also it reminds you to also slow down. And I love reliving. I think I am quite childlike anyway. So I love reliving the most magical moments of childhood. Even though I had a traumatic life in some degrees, I never felt like I had a traumatic childhood. I think my parents were really great about just making sure that we really had great lives and great childhoods. And it's been really great for me to be able to do that with my kids and to be present. I think for me, and I would love to hear your opinion on this, because I see how you parent as well, and your kids are much older, but they come back home and you guys have, you know, family dinners, and you're always doing great things. And I think that's the one thing that a parent really wants. I live in constant terror of the anxiety, firstly of dying before my kids are old and I've like helped them in the world, but also of just making sure and I'm sure we all screw up our kids somehow, that I don't screw them up too much. And, you know, how do you balance that? I'm away from them quite a bit right now. I'm trying to do it for them, but also they would probably like me to physically be there. There's all these things that you have to deal with as a parent, and I'd be interested in how you were able to really balance. I'm still figuring it out. So Robbie's 5 and Akani's 18 months, so I've still got a long way to go learning some of these lessons.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a big part of it I can actually thank Sara, my wife, for, because I became the managing director of Ogilvy Cape Town at a very young age. I was like 32 years old and I became a dad at 34. And I used to work all hours. I mean, you know, I didn't win that job in a competition. I worked really, really hard. And, you know, kind of like, how do you kind of bubble up to the top of a big company at such a young age? And that's through, I guess, a combination of talent and ability and work ethic. But when Sara fell pregnant, she said to me, I want you home at 5:30 every night now, and that you're there to help me bath the kids. My eldest is Ricky, who's now turning 24 this year. And I've got two other boys, Jake and Anthony, and they are my life. You know, Sara and my boys are my life. You know, I love my career and I love my friends and my colleagues that I work with. But being a dad is the most important thing in my life, and being a husband. And it was the same being a son to my parents. But when you love what you do, I guess, and I love being a dad, it comes through because you want to spend time with your kids. You enjoy spending time with them, and they know that you enjoy spending time with them. So, you know, there's that rubbish, I guess, Victorian concept of children are to be seen and not heard. You know, and I think children are to be heard. They're there to be, you know, active participants. And I guess I grew up in a house where my grandparents and my parents adored us and wanted to hear our opinions. We weren't pushed into a corner and told to keep quiet. So I did learn quite a lot from them. But as I said, Sara used to say to me, please be home at 5:30 at night. And if I was going to be home at like 6 o'clock even. But I don't know how many meetings I'd be at where it was 5:15. And I'd say, I'm terribly sorry, everybody. And people would look at me in complete shock. Although I told them that I'd be leaving.
Kudos to you.
Yeah, that I would leave. And I would leave. I had the discipline to leave. And that didn't mean that once the kids went to bed at night, that I didn't go and sit at my computer at 9 o'clock at night and work until 11 or 12. I often did. You know, and if the child woke up, I didn't see it as Sara's job to change nappies or give the kid the bottle. So I would often be up at night with my kids.
A man ahead of his time.
You know, because it's a shared responsibility, you know. And I also did grow up in a house where I don't think that my dad ever changed a nappy or, you know, knew how to do much until he was much older, you know, in terms of making a cup of coffee even. Or truly, you know. But I just thought that you want to muck in, you want to experience it. So. Yeah. And that has been rewarded because my children enjoy spending time with me and Saw and traveling together and doing many wonderful things together.
Yeah, my only goal is to make sure that they feel loved, and I hope that that will come through and that, you know, they'll forgive me if there's any mistakes that we make along the way. But I love them so much and I enjoy everything to do with them.
I can see those beautiful parties that you that you throw and well, I can only say it's downhill from here because you don't get much better than those parties that you throw. So we're in the home stretch of this conversation. At the end of each episode of Willing and Able, I like to ask a cornerstone question, if you like. And my question for you today is, what important thing have you changed your mind about in your own life where you might have held a strongly held position on something that you've now rethought or reconsidered?
It's a good one. I think the concept of whether people can change or not.
That's interesting.
When I was growing up and after everything that had happened to my family, I had a hit list of people that I thought when I was older, I was definitely going to go after them for what they had done. And I felt it very strongly in my soul. I mean, I really didn't conceptualize whether I was going to kill them or anything, but
here's the taxi boss in you talking. I'm terrified.
I didn't know what I was going to do, but I felt like I needed to do something. And one of those people that had come into our home the one day and shot into our beds where we would have been sleeping, but luckily my mom had taken us to school just earlier that day. And so she was left in there fighting for her life and ran out of the house. And there was a restaurant across the road from my house, so she ran in her sort of nightdress in there. And there was, you know, the patrons who saw this man with a shotgun running after her, who then tackled him down. And that person was my uncle.
Oh, wow.
And for years, I...
Being your dad's brother.
And my mom's brother.
Your mom's brother.
So, I mean, there was everyone was being bought off, you know.
Oh, my word.
Yeah, my granny tried to, on my father's side, tried to even poison my brother. There was lots of money at stake. But for years, I held on to deep, deep hatred, I think.
I can understand that.
And just...
I mean, you saw your mom's brother try to kill his sister.
Well, I wasn't there, but it was, you know.
But that's what we're talking about here, just to put a finer point on it.
This is what happened, and he also shot into where we would have been sleeping, so he would have tried to kill us too. And this was an uncle that was close to us, so we'd grown up with this person. And for a long time, I just, you know, I couldn't grasp myself around the concept of how this could happen. And
well, hate would be a natural response.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's the wrong response. I can understand and relate to that, yeah.
And I... hated him for what he'd done to my mom and my family and vowed, you know, to have never spoken to him again and just never thought that he could have changed from the person that he had been. Over the years, you know, my mom's forgave him, which I was very angry about. Wow. And we almost didn't speak for 5 months, my mom and she had told me. And this was just, you know, 5 years ago. And I only started speaking to her again. And my mom and I are very close when I got pregnant and told her that I was pregnant with my daughter. And, you know, then we had the conversation. But then that also meant that I had to now speak to him because he was now back into her life, which was, I suppose, now looking back, like, huge of her. And he had changed.
Really?
And he had really changed and in his own way made atonements. And I went from being terrified to being around him. And I mean, I'm still slightly, you know, just always alert. But
just keep that pepper spray or taser on
just
hand.
Always alert. But he's somebody that is in our lives now.
Really?
And he does seem to have fundamentally changed and really, you know, come to terms with what he had done and everything. And I would never have thought that. I mean, there's a number of examples of these kinds of things, but I mean, that's the one that's glaring, I suppose, is I've changed my mind about whether people can change or not.
Did he go to jail for that crime?
He went to jail at that time, sort of because he was caught and whatever, but I don't know if it was because my mom couldn't testify against her brother or if there was pressure from the family or what happened, but he didn't stay in there for very long.
Oh, really?
And so that was also another sense of the injustice that I felt about the whole situation. So
that's a very remarkable story, and it's a story that I'm actually going to choose to leave this conversation on because I think it's so powerful that, you know, my automatic thing is to then segue into something that is light and you and I can then have a laugh about it. But I think that forgiveness and understanding, you've pushed to the nth degree in this particular thing because it's a particularly unique story, and please God, he has changed and has learned his lessons and becomes the uncle and brother that he needs to be. Actually, it's remarkable.
It is indeed.
Mbali, thanks so much for joining me today. I mean, this has been an unbelievably deep and rich conversation, multi-layered. It's certainly been fascinating to hear how simple ideas are sometimes much more layered and complicated underneath the surface.
Thank you so much for having me too. It's been really great. And I really love what you've done, this idea of the podcast. I think it's really great. And I'm looking forward to listening to your other guests as well. I know it's going to happen.
Thanks so much for listening today. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not leave us a 5-star review? And that's a wrap for the first season of Willing and Able. Thank you so much for tuning in to these conversations, and I hope to have more conversations that challenge perspectives very soon. Be sure you subscribe so that you don't miss any upcoming episodes. Thank you.
This podcast is produced by Two Stories, written by Linda Scarborough, produced by Carol Williams, with audio editing, engineering, and sound design by Kozim Zimela, with production assistance from MNC Saatchi Group South Africa's team, Maciek Dubla and Nadia Siegel. Special thanks to Sonic Nursery and Edible Audio for the recording of these episodes. I know.